Welcome to the Time and Motion podcast with me, your host, Lee Stevens. For over 25 years, I've worked with businesses all over the world to improve the technology and the people within them. In this podcast, I share some of my experiences and I chat to guests who generously share their stories of how to, or in some cases, how not to, live a productive life. I hope you enjoy the show. Hi, Ben. Ben Shapiro from Data Weavers.
Hey, Lee.
How are you, mate?
Very good, very good.
Thanks for taking the time for this second go at the podcast.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Good to sit down and have a chat.
As I was just explaining off air, I think it was the first or second week I'd arrived in Brisbane, and I've arrived very flustered and probably not putting my best broadcast OS on, and was it in the right frame of mind. So really kind of you to go at this the second time.
No, my pleasure. My pleasure. Yeah, it was a good chat.
Perfect. All right. So maybe it's good to kind of just remind the listeners, you know, who you are and what's your life all about.
So, well, you know, my name's Ben Shapiro, but I'm not the American guy. I use that one as a bit of a funny skit. I actually had someone in gym this morning come up to me and goes, "Are you really Ben Shapiro? Do you get shit for that?" I'm like, no. People realize I'm not the real guy when they look at me. At the moment, current startup is Data Weavers, and we're essentially a platform as a service that automates and manages cloud infrastructure for Sitecore. That's a big digital experience application. And the basis of that is that we organize and manage all the infrastructure so the people who use the platform can actually spend their time building good and great digital experiences.
So a very tech-heavy business, and we'll come on to that in a moment.
And it's sort of, you think about where we're at, we're sort of in the back house, so we actually, the back of house side of things. So we enable people who are front of house to actually get more done, and we really manage all the back of house logistics around core infrastructure and cloud infrastructure.
So essentially it's all the big sites and the customer experience platforms that you use for those big sort of global corporations.
They tend to be, our customers are really enterprise organizations sort of billion-dollar plus organizations. So large number of people, you know, typically have some sort of product or service to sell through that cloud channel and cloud platform. And they spend most of their time either ensuring compliance for the content that's out there, or enabling sales channels to make things happen through these digital platforms as well too. So they unfortunately spend a lot of time managing infrastructure, which is like the techie stuff, which has nothing to do with what their job is, but they have to do it. And so, that's where our niche is. We kind of make that easy, streamlined, and automated.
What would be some of those larger companies or large organizations that you host? Are you allowed to say?
Yeah, well, I just refrain from saying, but I probably can say, there's sort of the likes of Toyota, Global Payments, Subway. We've got Stanford Hospital as well, too, in America. Beckman was a client that just went live today, actually. So, sort of large enterprises, and that's a mixture of obviously automotive, there's health, life sciences, financial services. So we get across, quite a large, varied number of industries, but that's more of a reflection of those industries looking for an enterprise, digital experience platform that they want to use and sort of integrate their data, which is coming from a CRM or coming from an ERP or something where their customer data sits, and actually having that exposed out through the web. So there's not a lot of enterprise grade systems that do that. So there's only a few choices in the market.
Yep. Okay. And we did talk about this off air, but Brisbane, you're a Brisbane boy, born and bred. Your story there?
Yes.
I was going to ask the second question everyone asks in Brisbane, which is what school you went to.
Yeah.
I'm definitely
Brisbane born and bred. So, for my sins, I think actually quite fortunately, because if I look at what I've done out of Brisbane, I've always been an entrepreneur. I don't know anything but being an entrepreneur, and that sort of facilitated a lot of things I've fortunately been able to create and have experiences around. So I went to Grace College, so that's kind of on the peninsula, Redcliffe Peninsula.
That is now.
You do know it, yeah. nice place. I wouldn't say it's part of the broader school, the big, the Brisbane school network. Yeah. They're certainly not part of that. But, it's interesting to kind of see how that really didn't have any effect on what I did. And in fact, it had zero, impact on what I'm doing.
Yep. And then uni?
University. Went to Griffith University, did back then it was a Bachelor of Arts, but now it's a Bachelor of Business in Leisure Management. So sort of sports administration. I was pretty heavy into sports at that stage. I've come from a sporty family. My sister's an Olympian, softball in 2000, 2004. And I actually was sailing quite a lot too at that stage. So doing quite a lot of world championship type sailing, and sort of put on a world championship as well too. So I, you know, that for my, I guess for my sins and what I do, it just was, you know, a little bit different from what was happening as well too. You know, got myself out of Brisbane and kind of into the global stage and things.
Yeah. And then early career, what did that look like?
Early career was pretty much out of school. Dad introduced me to a guy he worked with at Ericsson, and Ericsson's like big telecommunications provider. They they were working on a bit of software that actually optimized radio networks. And so radio networks being mobile phones, these things are radios.
Yeah.
And back in the day, you couldn't actually measure signal strength unless you were inside a van, you know, with a whole bunch of antennas and stuff, and you drive around and find that. And they had a whole bunch of those guys going around measuring signals, brought it back to their planning station, and then kind of went through and said, well, for every big bit of infrastructure they had, their sort of infrastructure is the big telephone poles you see with the big lobes of radio off the top of that. For every one of those, which is about $1 million each, how do you actually get enough subscribers on the network with having as few of those bits of hardware as possible? And it was an impossible task. The optimization task was like you had to do it manually. Anyway, these guys in Sweden figured out a way to do it automatically. And they were all like, yep, no, that doesn't work. They had a pilot site in MTN in South Africa. And I got introduced to them through my dad. And they basically said, can I have the south part of the world? And, you know, let me see if I can sell it. I was like 17. End up selling it to Bell South in New Zealand, actually, which is Vodafone. And I still remember the day kind of rocked in with a little laptop and a 3.5-inch floppy drive.
Shane, your age there.
Yep. And went up to the engineering guy and I said, oh, can I have an extract of your GIS tool? Grabbed it, ran it for 14 minutes, handed the thing back to him, the floppy drive back to him. And he said, thanks, kid. I'll see you later. And that was pretty much the conversation. I went, okay, righto. Well, I'll give you a call tomorrow. I'm staying in Auckland. I'll see how it goes. And effectively gave us a call the next day and, yeah, $1 million sale. So, and so that was pretty interesting. And that kind of, I took that as a great experience and had a fair bit of commission out of that. So I kind of went and then sold Bell South was the first, and then yep. Optus Australia, Hutchies in Hong Kong, Smart in the Philippines as well too. So as a sort of 17, 18, you know, 19 year old, I was like, that was my first thing.
So cutting your teeth in that telco world and, you know,
quite complex, complex solutions.
I was about to say quite complex, probably helped you in later in your career.
Look, I think probably that's the pattern I figured out. It's
a lot
of these big systems, you know, take a lot of understanding of how they all go together. And then I still sort of joke today that a lot of people who work in the internet don't really understand how the internet works. And but by understanding how things go together, it's to me, it's like plain as day. You can easily say these things actually need to work in a certain way.
Yep. And then when we spoke last time, we found out we had some shared connections in the Microsoft consulting space. So how did you end up in that world?
With Mr. Newman?
Yeah, with Andy, yeah.
Ryan? Yeah. So, so the back story is Brian and I, so after the work I did in telecommunications, I actually started a software business. It was a service and software business, and we did SharePoint, and we did a bunch of early SharePoint stuff, and lo and behold, a guy called Brian Cook actually did some early SharePoint stuff, and we were both gold partners, and I actually met Brian at a Melbourne offsite at a really nice, beautiful old country estate down there. And we got on like a house on fire and we're like, oh man, we should be doing things together. And at that stage, I was kind of, you know, still trying to grow my business, which was called DCG. And we're doing a lot of work in Queensland government, like had a lot of ministerial connections as well too. And we sort of went from, let's do something together to it didn't sort of come together the way, for no real particular reason either. It sort of just drifted a little bit. And then I got a little bit defocused because Avanade came on the scene and I sold my business to Avanade. And anyway, so we kind of separated for a while there and still kept in touch. And after I'd kind of gone through the Avanade, you know, journey and, you know, Brian laughing at me or whatever, and saying, you know, you're working for the man again instead of, you know, working for yourself. Interesting, really interesting journey that for me though, was I basically ended up being a, you know, Siebel architect. So working on Siebel and CRM systems, so big complex CRM systems, ATO change program, also New South Wales government licensing. So I actually put those, you know, worked heavily in those two systems and got bored with that and thinking probably something to what you said is I actually don't know. I'm a pretty bad employee.
Yeah.
And I kind of, you kind of lose yourself a little bit and going, I'm not sure, if I really want to do this, and you know, what do I stand for, etc. And anyway, I made the choice to leave that, and sort of found myself a little bit lost for a while. Did we work with Fujitsu up here as well too, which is great. I mean, that was an awesome experience too.
When you say doing some work with, that was working for them?
Or? Working for them, yeah.
Yeah, so you're kind of like similar to me, right? You've kind of dabbled with the dark side of employment.
And, yeah, it actually took a lot for me to take that job. I think it was like 4 or 5 months of convincing that I really wanted to go. I'm like, there's no way, it's impossible. You're too big and too, you know, clunky. I can't actually do anything with that.
Yeah.
Anyway, they're saying, yeah, great thing. It's great to be involved, but a lot of really great experiences there too. And I guess including selling mainframes, believe it or not, from being an internet guy.
Yeah. So you quite nonchalantly said, oh, yeah, I just sold my business to have an odd, you know, for the people listening, they're a joint.
Yeah, they were actually a baby of both Microsoft and Accenture.
Microsoft and Accenture,
had $1 billion to actually get started, so they had a fair bit of coin to make things happen. And they're still very entrenched in that world today.
Yeah, but obviously it sounds like you've sold at least two businesses, maybe more. Mm. But I mean, just for those kind of listening on that note, you know, you don't just wake up one day and go, yeah, I'll just kind of sell that business. So you presumably you would have either got a lot of attention in the right way, you know, doing what you do is quite niche. And a lot of people who buy businesses, they're doing it because they just don't want to grow it from scratch, right? Mm. They probably could, but it's a lot, they can do it a lot quicker.
Yeah, the 0 to 1 part's hard.
But from your perspective in terms of selling those businesses, you know, did you do anything particularly on that basis to think, well, okay, well, if that goes and, you know, if I go and do this, then I've got more chance of selling? You know, was you doing anything consciously to do it?
No, actually, no. I think it's the opposite. I feel like if you try, well, no, that's not necessarily true. I think I plan that a little bit more these days. But, you know, back in the day, I was doing stuff that I believed in, I loved and, you know, really passionate about and very focused. So, again, complex system, SharePoint in itself is a completely, you know, one of the most complex systems that on the surface looks like really easy to use. And we specialized in that, but we also did, that was the second thing we did in that business. The first thing we did was actually took ERP systems. So Great Plains, Navision and Solomon. I don't know if you know
those. Early Microsoft
ones. Yeah. Before they actually went back into.
So before Dynamics, once again, for those listening, Dynamics was a thing, they had the suite of 4 or 5, I think it was.
They acquired all those at the time. Yeah,
different kind of finance systems and CRM systems, et cetera.
Yeah. So we were putting sort of web front ends on ERP back ends. To actually do so, the business process part of like a web system, and that was back in the day. It was actually really complicated to do. That was actually a hard thing to do. It was still using classic ASP for the programmers out there, which is like clunky and hard work. So we had a niche in that sort of building essentially process systems, really helping people organize, you know, everything from financial instruments to other internal processes, but putting those front end those process systems on the ERP backends. And I had this crazy idea back in the day. It was like, you know, this internet thing, it's got to be a bit of a mixture of creative, a bit of a mixture of interactive and and the tech all in one place. And I kind of built a team of people who were really great creatives, really great interactive people back in the day when it was sort of halfway between video and vector animation and some really hardcore techies who could build core applications. And so we just had a really cool mix of people and did really cool things. And expertise in those more complex systems led us into conversations with the Queensland government quite a lot, did quite a lot of their SharePoint systems. And we just sort of – we seemed like the right acquisition target for Avanade because, you know, I was working heavily with Microsoft state managers and all the key account people. I was working heavily with all the Accenture partners as well too. So it just, you know, that's sort of more or less how it came about.
What was that business called?
DCG.
DCG, okay, yeah. So a lot of people listening in Brisbane will probably...
Yeah, Dynamic Concepts was the first name of it. So I sort of did this in and shortened it.
Yeah, cool. All right. And you mentioned about a lot of government work in Brisbane. And I mean, one thing I would say, having been in the city for 6 months, that jumps out at me is how dependent a lot of consulting firms are on that government work. Mm. So, yeah, back in Christchurch in New Zealand, I made a point of steering away from governments and councils and if I could, because it was just hard work and the procurement process, it just kind of just weren't worth the end result. But whereas feels like slightly different here, the fact that you have to do it because there's so much work in Brisbane that's government related. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, look, and probably a little bit of perhaps bias to what I've actually seen as well too, but in all the sort of iterations, there's always, except for this business we're in now, very much this, if you're Queensland focused and Brisbane oriented, then there's so much government work, it's not funny.
What do you have to do differently when that's the case?
I'm not sure. Differently from what perspective? I think.
Well, do you run your business differently? I mean, obviously, procurement cycles are different. Maybe the people that are different. You need through consulting. Is there anything in particular you feel that you have to do?
Maybe it's the way I look at it. I'm not sure I would do anything different. And I think about who our ICP is or who our customer is really, and what are we trying to serve and how do we fix problems for them? And I've always probably thought about it this way too. So I didn't sort of say I want to fix stuff for government. It just happened to be that a lot of what SharePoint stands for from an intranet point of view and how you actually organize knowledge and complex systems, there's a lot of use cases for, organizations who produce lots of documents who don't know what to do with them, but they need to share knowledge. It just happens to kind of be a good use case for that. And, and sort of some of the larger commercial places are part of that as well too. But there's, right in our backyard, there's half a dozen, 20 government departments who are doing that thing as well too. So for me, it's just, I always think about what our use case is in terms of the tech we understand, but then we're building bespoke as well too. But also knowing that, think about what the customers need, you just sort of spin around that and then build a business on that. And again, for my sins, I've been doing a lot of complex sales as well too. So I know what complex selling looks like. And my dad was a great teacher for that as well too. He did some awesome, massively complex sales in local government, but also sort of enterprise like Bundaberg Sugar and defence as well too. So big, long sales cycles, and I learned a lot from him as well. So it's sort of, I guess it's my comfy space as well. Enterprise, I'm comfortable with enterprise. I know how it works, and you just set your organisation up to do that. But, win the customer first, as we were talking about. Mm. Win the customer, yeah. Go on. And back in the day, it was all about, I still joke today about sales. It's a contact sport. You've got to actually go and see people to make it happen.
Yeah, and we were just talking about this sort of off air, and I have some strong opinions on that. And so if you speak to a lot of CEOs, just like I do, and a lot of sort of senior executives, the common theme at the moment is that they don't want to be sold to, right? So like, I turn on LinkedIn, it's just like this tsunami of people trying to sell me stuff and, email, I just put everything into, my junk folder or set my filters. I go, how do you sell? They go, oh yeah, we do LinkedIn outreach and we do email outreach. Right? So it's like everyone's kind of trying to get attention in a very noisy world. And, as I say, I joked, I feel like there's almost the point where you maybe should send a letter to someone, to go against the tide. But I still maintain, I think we both agreed on this, that people buy from people, and that never changes. It's just a little bit harder these days to actually get in front of someone, which
I think the trick that we're finding as well too with obviously we're sort of globally expanding from Brisbane, and it's relevant, so it's always relevant. So I think it's one of the things that happens in that sort of online world, and especially LinkedIn as well, it's there's zero context to actually why an email got sent. And perhaps very, very little research as to why it's going to be interesting for me, and what something that I can solve, they can solve for me right now today. And so we focus a lot on that in terms of how we do outreach as well too for our organization. So we're very specific. We solve a very specific problem in a market that is, always interested in trying to find and fix problems. They're big problems. So how to
look. And you almost take that approach where you go, well, why wouldn't they want to talk to me? I know they've got that problem. Yeah. So,
well, I always say too that, pretty much everyone who's got their Sitecore, we can help. We can help them in one way, shape or form. And, I guess we're a help first organization. That's how we think about it. So there's nothing we're trying to sell anyone. It's just like, we know they've got problems. We know we can help.
So let's move on to current project, current gig.
Yep.
Why did that come about? And did you have a break after selling the last thing? Or, what did you was you go and work for someone? What was the, how did the, that idea come about, and how did you get it going?
Well, it's probably a few past. So I didn't, out of, the Fujitsu days, it's kind of, that was the, the point when I actually reconnected with Brian and got onto the Andy thing. So
yeah. So just explain who Brian and Andy are.
So Brian Cook, who I was talking about previously, Brian Cook, who was one, and Brett Campbell, who are the original founders of OBS, SharePoint focused organization, very similar to what we were doing with DCG. Yep. Brian and I and Brodo sort of hit it off, and you know, it didn't end up having getting together at the time, but sort of made some really good connections and frameworks on that.
So. It's funny, I was if the OBS, if I call them like the SharePoint Mafia. So I was out with Mark Rhodes. I don't know if you know
Mark.
So I was out for dinner with Mark, and it's being Brisbane. I knew he was in Brisbane somewhere. I went into a post office a few weeks ago, turned around. I was like, I know that guy. And it's like, it was Mark Rhodes. Mm. And so, yeah, we had dinner with the wives at the weekend. And he obviously was another one from those OBS days. But lots of, I think, you know, certainly in the SharePoint world, and both in the Northern and Southern Hemisphere, it was definitely like a breeding ground of good SharePoint people.
Yeah,
right? And still to this day, I think, you know, people are involved in the Microsoft world and the MVP world. You know, I think those guys should have a lot of pride with it.
I'm very fortunate that I guess my path crossed with Brian and Brad at the time, and then obviously Andy later. We're doing similar things, and it was just had a bit more momentum with what they had because there was a bigger market in Melbourne, and had managed to break into Adelaide first. So me on that trip is Brian called me one day when I was working at Fujitsu, and he goes, "Dude, what are you doing?" And I'm like, "Oh, I'm just kind of hanging out." And he goes, "Oh, let's catch up for coffee. I'm like, okay. Well, I'm down here. It was down at Emporium, actually. He rocks up and he goes, "Man, we've got to get the band back together." And I'm like, "Righto, what's happening?" He's like, "I was just speaking to Microsoft and a bunch of other planning meetings, and he goes, I really want you to, should start up, get back involved, get into OBS, you know, whole bunch of sort of, we're doing well, blah, 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 all et cetera." I'm like, "Yeah, maybe I'll think about it." But obviously, I'm pretty interested in trying to connect with Brian and Brett and get the guys going back together again. But I was sort of a little bit sort of standoffish thinking, "Oh, I'm not sure," you know, probably a little bit where you're thinking, because once you come out of one thing, do I want to go back down to another? Yeah. Anyway, we did the dance, and it was like, "Yeah, cool, okay, I'll start." So I started Brisbane from scratch. We went from nothing to 24 people real quick. Mr. Rhodes is one of those people as well too. And then sort of after that, it was like, it was sort of 12 months or so, 15 months. He goes, come to Melbourne. I'm like, "Oh, okay, righto." So I packed up and moved to Melbourne.
Did you have family at the time?
Yeah. Yeah. I started OBS Brisbane when my first boy was born. So 13th of March is when we started, 2008. Mm. And I'm still married to the same person. So
thankfully.
So she's very patient. She's an entrepreneur as well too.
So you had a bit of a time out then after you did the OBS thing, moved to Melbourne, and then then what? How'd you end up back in Brisbane?
Well, actually, after we went through OBS, grew that, you know, got involved with the Nintex team, was on the exec part of that business. So I was straddling both, working closely with Brian and Brett, I was fortunate as being part of that exec team. We learned a whole bunch of stuff. Again, got exposed to, you know, growing a business, you know, 160 plus people in the services business, one best place to work, 2012, beat Salesforce and Google, learned some cool, really cool stuff around business and people and culture, and just worked with some exceptional people. And Andy was part of that. Another lady by the name of Alice Hanna, who's part of that as well too. So, we just had a really awesome exec team. And, you sort of think about that. It's like trying to put that back together is one of my little things. I'm like, how do I put a team like that back together? Because that's kind of exciting. And learnt those lessons. And we being part of the sort of growing up and selling, and Nintex was going and flying. Nintex had just got a big investment from TA Associates, which was, you know, a couple hundred million. The services business essentially was looking to get sold, sell that business to Empire. Supposed to go with the team, chose not to at the end of the day. Set some nice stuff up for Andy, so that's probably where. Mr. Newman.
Let him buy his chocolate.
Yeah, that's right. And I sort of was like, I think I need to investigate new stuff, like look at what the marketing side of the world. So in like the later days of OBS and Nintex, and as we're sort of maturing it, we're doing quite a lot of, marketing automation, you know, with a click dimensions. Yep. Yeah. So, and we were one of the early resellers of that too, thinking about how this works and comes together. And
so those are the guys that essentially were a bolt on for CRM. That like you did probably outreach
email.
And
email. No, it wasn't outreach. It was just straight email. Yeah. So it was email, sort of account based marketing, I guess, what we know as now.
So
early
email
days.
The 20 people or 200 people in this group.
Yeah, here's the look. Yeah, here's what they've done. Here are the interactions. Here are the click trails. This is what people.
It seems mad, doesn't it? Like you look back and you go, sure, that stuff should have just been in the product. But obviously, it was a different world in those days.
Yeah, it's the interaction, the ability to interact with things. So I was fascinated with that, and I felt like there was anything new to learn. You know, going with the rest of the crew, even though they're awesome people. Like you say that it's a fortunate just being part of that and that part, that journey and that pathway with great people. And everyone's in contact today too, which is, that's kind of really nice as well. Yeah. So thinking about that, where is my blind spot? What don't I know? And, I was thinking, well, the marketing stuff, I've kind of always been sort of broadly connected to marketing and sort of, I wanted to explore that a bit more. And it's like, where could I do that? How could I find that? Searching around, got found by Headhunter, and basically one of the large groups called Dentsu, was Dentsu Aegis at the time. Kind of, there was a role in the group, working with the group chief exec. I can learn some things here. So working with some diversified businesses and I sort of thought, I'm going to take it. It's just going to help me learn. Also, I might be able to do some marketing automation stuff. Surely that's where it's at. Turns out that a large part of that organization is very much focused on ads, and I'm not an ad guy. I'm a services or a product kind of guy, thinking about how things go together. And so ads ain't my thing.
To create a spark wasn't there, or not as much as others anyway.
I love the energy, the creative. It's awesome. And it was sort of my early days too. We had some great creatives. We won a bunch of awards as well too. So I was kind of like, almost like, oh, can I go back to that? Turns out that it's a very big driver of where that org revenue is. Large organization too, so lots of different things. Really, it's a combination of multiple brands, many, many brands together. And I was sort of part of the head co. And as a result of that, you're sort of a little bit divorced from what the brands are doing too. But, you know, I had to essentially get myself pulled across multiple brands and had multiple business cards and, you know, did quite a lot of talking and thinking about how we could put things together from a systems point of view, marketing automation. None of those actually panned out though. So I realized that I had a limited ability to get influence. So I was thinking at the time, I was like, I think I can do this myself. And so I started a business called Triggerfish, and it was basically in saying enterprise web, 90-day deliveries, fixed prices, and then continual delivery. Because one of the things that happens with enterprise marketing, big platforms, is that you spend, I don't know, 18 months, 24 months, 36 months to put the platform in, and then nothing else happens.
So here's a question, right? So I think I'm going to know the answer to this already, but so when you have that idea and you say, I'm going to go and do it, you probably didn't do a lot of the validation and, you know, try and get product market fit like we all have to do these days, right? You probably just knew, had a hunch that it was a thing and off you went. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, well, interestingly, I was interested in HubSpot. So HubSpot was pretty new back then. And I'm thinking, there's one platform that can do that. It's obviously not super enterprise at the stage, but it's kind of a mid-market. Yeah. And I don't know, see how that goes, and managed to kind of help out with a few great people. So Lane Beachley, she had a thing called Aim for the Stars. So I kind of did some, I helped out there. I knew some people who knew some people and did some work there and sort of had a bit of a play and said, well, okay, this will work, and did some good stuff there. And then I just went, well, I services business is probably, for me, a little bit less about product market fit, because it's like, I can see the need. I can see it a mile away. It's
worst case scenario, you just pivot slightly. And
yeah, I don't know. I've always felt confident in seeing the need from a services point of view. So product is different, because you've got to almost make choices about what you don't want to do for product. But services, you can kind of pretty much get it right. But I was really particular. I had some experiences where they weren't doing the right thing by the customer, and, you know, they were doing things that only devs wanted to do, and the customer just had to deal with it. And I'm like, I'm not sure that I like that. That's not cool. Anyway, it is what it is when you're talking about big deals, but, you know, that's what I took away. I went, well, 90-day deliveries, enterprise, things that have stood up, and actually talk about this idea where you operate it from day 91. So instead of being 180 days to set up, it's 90 days, and then operate it from day 91 and continue operating. Because that's really where the value is in these big marketing platforms and digital experience platforms. When you operate them, is really what you want to do to collect the data and see the click trails and all the things that Click Dimensions was doing.
So in those early days, I guess, as it wasn't your first rodeo, as they say, you probably knew you couldn't do it on your own. So was you already thinking, like, you know, even before the idea, oh, I'm going to hire this person, I'm going to need one of those, need two of those, or, you know, what was those? Because I think that's obviously a lot of entrepreneurs kind of battle with that, right? They go, look, I know I need these people. And myself included, I was definitely in that camp. I know I'm going to need people to truly scale this business. So it can't just be me doing everything plus a couple other people. But at the same time, you know, I don't know if I really want to, you know, take the risk. But I think once you've done, it's not risk once you've done it once, because you go, well, it's the only way we can do it, right? So, but yeah, where was your headspace there when you kind of knew you were going to have to, you know, ramp the team up?
Ramping the team was probably different. That sort of happened after we won a couple of clients when I better find a team.
Yeah, so you'd still get a couple of wins and then
That gave you that. I'm a big advocate of that too. It's and maybe that's just my way, that I'll go find a customer, we'll win the customer. You know, I've got enough for my sins, also got enough skills to kind of get the first bit done. But then once you kind of create that demand and the ongoing demand, like that's when, who do I need to backfill for me? Who do I need to backfill me? And then it kind of becomes a backfill me, backfill me, backfill those people. And now the conversations I have with managers today is like, how do you get let go of that vine, delegate, you know, and it's still like that whole delegation for entrepreneurs, it's actually hard.
It's tough. Yeah. It's hard. Yeah. And I think a lot of it is that everyone thinks it's because you're a control freak, which it probably is in some cases.
You are a control freak.
But I think the second part of it is, I think when you actually enjoy, when we were just talking about it, it's like when you actually enjoy the work as well, when you enjoy the delivery side of it, you know, then that's another reason why, because you don't just, so like, I think towards the end of my days at Brighter Days, you know, I was nicknamed with Jazz Hands. They used to wheel me out, you know, go and do some glitz and glamour.
Go and talk and make him feel excited.
Exactly,
and we'll kind of go and sweep
excited,
up the
and
stuff.
Then we'll go and deliver it. You know, so go and promise the world, and you know, we'll go and do the delivery. And I think that was probably an element of loss there, because you go, actually, you know, I'm not the best person now to deliver this, and maybe it is the rest of the team. So yeah, so that's interesting, because I think a lot of time you do it because you're doing it because you enjoy the work.
A lot of my, like, why do I do it? I was sort of trying to figure out that lot, you know, really early on. But I always explain this as when I was a kid, I used to pull things apart and try to put it back together. And sometimes they worked and sometimes they didn't. But I always kind of had this idea of pulling things apart to work out how they go together. And then a lot of the way I think about businesses and opportunities and stuff is like, it's actually a combination of things. It's not just the one thing. It's not about pulling it apart. It's about putting it apart and assembling it with a few other things and taking that idea, which is a left wheel idea, and putting it with the right one and sort of making it work together. And so make it better is kind of my mantra. Like, I always want to make it better. How do we do things better? That's what drives me to be interested in continuing things. And so the big work that I'm trying to do is make things better.
You mentioned about ideal customer profile and making sure that obviously you service those people because you already know the problem that they've got. But how much of an issue was that when you was based in Brisbane, when all of the big boys and girls are based in Melbourne, Sydney, and then further afield, obviously in the States and London, etc. So was that ever a worry or a consideration for you?
Well, I guess it was a consideration. And I guess fortunately or otherwise, I guess early days for me, I'd been involved with international business. So I kind of saw that there wasn't – I mean, there's differences. There's clearly differences in the way things work. But, you know, I feel like – the markets, the ideas that come out of Australia and New Zealand too, quite frankly, we're like a really good test market for a lot of these big brands, because we're quite innovative. We take things up easily. You know, we're not big. So if something goes splat, nobody really gets too fired from that. And but I just realized the more that we think about things, and just what I've been involved with, it's all typically leading edge thinking. And when you take that to a bigger market, even with Triggerfish, when we first got into America, it feels like the bar's low. Like, we're just doing what we're normally doing, and we're miles ahead of everyone else. And I wouldn't say it was great. It was good. It's definitely good work. And I guess we do what we say we're doing. And I think maybe a lot of people don't do what they say they do. Yeah. So that's probably just another thing. Yeah. But it's the bar is, I think, from people who have to innovate in Australia, there's a lot of competition for a time. Like, there's not much customer work, but you've got to innovate. If you don't innovate, then you're kind of like, well, we'll choose someone else.
Yeah, and it's interesting because like certainly the move from New Zealand to Australia, it makes sense, right? You go, there's probably not as many, businesses in Christchurch doing what I'm doing. But then obviously you've times the amount of people by 10, you've probably got 10 times the amount of competitors as well. So it's all relative. So
that's harder, I think, in a smaller concentration because you have to then be different and be better than a handful of people who are all competing for the same stuff.
Yeah. And those relationships are probably, as we said, are just, even more important in those kind of tighter markets.
Well, I think it always comes down to perhaps that's the do what you say you're going to do. The trust, people that trust that you can see the problem, articulate it well, help them feel comfortable that you're actually making progress towards it, trust that you can get it done, you know, and obviously the proof is getting it done, but just simple stuff. But
so you mentioned about America. So once again, you don't just wake up and go, you know what, I'm going to go and pick a state or whatever, I'll go back a step. So in the tech world, I think everyone, that's the nirvana, right? Everyone wants to crack America. And all the good advice, having been out at the conferences over there, is that you don't crack America, you pick one state and then you try and go after that. But yeah, so just tell us about your early foray into the States. Was that a conscious effort? Was it reactive? How do you take your business international?
It actually started in England, actually. So we went to England first and because we thought it'd be easier to sort of, grow into a market that's similar, and turns out that we got into America before we got into England. So that was interesting. We put employees in England first, thinking that. So,
in London?
Yes, in London, yeah. So ex-OBSs as well too. Definitely tapping that network. But so we actually went because we'd won some business. We went to a big trade show, presented with a local customer around a complex financial. It's essentially a super fund, but, complex way of you dealing with customer communications and securing data and managing everything through one sort of digital channel. And just happened to be in the audience, a couple of big brands who said, that same problem I have got that I would really like to, we've spent probably 2 years trying to figure it out and we're nowhere, so can you help us figure that out? So that was our first sort of conversation. And then we won a couple of customers in America. I was like, oh, geez, how do we, we said, look, really honestly, we don't have anyone in America, but we can sort of help you. We've got someone in Europe that will sort of help bridge the time frame. Our plans to get to America, we've just got to kind of figure out how to do that. And so, they were based in, one in Atlanta, one in Miami.
Yeah, Florida. And I guess once again, the reason they're probably buying there is because that problem's so niche, right? Well, like, problem you're solving is there's probably very few people, even locally for them, that probably could solve. So they probably having to look further afield because it's quite a complex and niche problem.
A lot of what happens in the sort of world of digital experience is that people hire teams of people, which is fine. Ideally, when you think about process and how you actually, because we're really talking about process. The best person who knows the process is the people that are inside the business and work through that. I'd seen that through Nintex and OBS as well too, and all the SharePoint things, you probably would have seen that too. It's all about process. And so it would make sense to kind of find the SME, build a team, but then there's what happens in big organizations is there's lots of other things that are going on. It's sometimes quite hard to connect between business units. There's sort of different agendas that happen. So all of that just slows everything down. So, it's pretty easy to see a project go from, like maybe not even 90 days, but let's say it's like 6 months to 24 months real quick. That doesn't take very much of a stretch at all. And so, what we're fixing for in superannuation here, that same problem exists in every single superannuation company in Australia, every pension type company in America, and anyone really, forget about the industry, anyone who's dealing with a cohort of customers who actually need to be kind of dealt with in a very personalized way. So that pattern that we've used could be used in any sort of one of those sort of approaches. So all of a sudden we're not dealing with a superannuation fund, it's anyone who's got anything to do with customer and managing customer personalization. And because we're dealing with customer records basically. So it's pretty easy to kind of abstract it to say, well, the core of what we've got is this. But it obviously makes a lot of sense to say, that same pattern we've got actually is a pattern we've got in, it happened to be in sort of food and beverage actually is the one of the customers. So financial services pattern that we used in food and beverage because they have the same way they did franchises.
Yep.
Okay. And so in Brisbane, as we talked about, you're running a business, employing a few people in Brisbane and further afield. What would you say is the biggest challenge you've got running a Brisbane-based business at the moment? It might not necessarily be the fact that it's Brisbane-based, but what would you say your sort of top three challenges are still?
I don't know if it's the challenges. I mean, I'm a glass half full guy, so I do recognise the spectrum of things, but Brisbane, I feel like Brisbane these days is connected to everywhere, so I haven't really had any. Maybe it's not the centre of a lot of Australian-based decisions, so you do have to get on a plane and actually be face to face with people in Sydney and Melbourne and Canberra. So that's a reality. But with COVID, that sort of disappeared for a while. Yeah. So people were very, very comfortable with just jumping on a Teams meeting or Zoom or whatever your flavour is. And for a while that sort of made sense. But as you're sort of saying, I think now there's a little bit of a tide shifting back to the other way. It's like, actually, I would like to speak to someone. I would like to, yes, we can do some Teams meetings, but I actually want to, eyeball you and just make sure that we're on the same page and you can feel like I can trust you. So that, so that's one thing. So, and I'd say that broadly is the problem with Australia. We're so far away from things that any to deal with anything internationally is, 14 to 17 to 24 hours of plane travel to get there. And so that's probably one of the bigger barriers I see is maybe not so inside of Australia and from Brisbane, you could be anywhere in Australia, yeah, really. It's just you've got to be face to face with people. So actually answer the question, what's the issue? What are the barriers?
Some challenges, yeah.
If we had a bigger talent pool here, things would be easier for sure. And I think one of the problems with Brisbane's identity that it's sort of rectifying is that, people felt like it's nicer or better to live in Melbourne or Sydney. And I was one of those guys. I moved from Brisbane to Melbourne and lived there for like 7 years, thinking, oh, it's great, And then actually everyone's laughing at me going, you're moving the wrong way, mate. And I'm like, no, it's good. It's going to be awesome. But in fairness, I actually have a very soft spot for Melbourne as well too. But coming back to Brisbane from living in Melbourne, the weather's generally great. It's very, very easy to kind of mix life and work together.
Yeah. I feel like the term I use, so as you can imagine, we lived in New Zealand for 10 years and obviously spent a big time in London. We're sort of born and bred. But I kind of call Brisbane like the Goldilocks city because I kind of feel like it's just right in terms of population and number of businesses and maybe the weather's not quite Goldilocks, can be, obviously it's pretty pleasant, right? And, obviously we have a bit of rain, but it's a nice place, especially with the Olympics. And I think a lot of people in Australia probably realised that after COVID as well, hence the house prices and the influx of people moving into the state. So I think it's a nice place to live, it's a nice place to bring up children, So I think that's all got a lot going for it, right?
Definitely. And I think the point of, I was talking to a friend from Melbourne last night as well, who still lives in Melbourne. It's actually one of our good friends we met and sort of lifelong friendship type guy, and then he sort of even goes, I love coming to Brisbane rather than go to Adelaide because I can walk, I can lob into the city and I can walk everywhere, and you don't get mobbed or swamped. And so there's some like that, just doing that and sort of being able to kind of integrate the work and life thing is kind of number one reason why I'd want to move to Brisbane.
I almost feel like you kind of need to live in Brisbane but do your work like internationally, which is probably what you do, right?
I don't see. So for me, I'm fortunate. I've actually got QICs on our cap table now too. So, and to me, I actually strategically said, I definitely want QIC on our cap table because we've got some private investors as well too, but like 5V and OIF, but I thought just because of the nature of what QIC is and the government and,
QIC for those listening overseas?
QIC is Queensland Investment Corporation, but is also, believe it or not, QIC has a huge distribution of funds in the US and gets large funds managers to look after their funds. So they're actually a really big sort of source of funds.
The corporate investors.
Absolutely. Yeah. But there's something about how that type of, I guess let's call it a serious, not that the other people aren't serious investors, but the sort of large investor on our cap table sort of shows, you know, it's reach, it's people who they know, and a lot of that is we want to leverage a lot of that too. So,
yeah.
I know it's kind of nice that that's in the backyard, right? Like, I feel fortunate that, just down the road, literally, you can kind of talk to people who are dealing with billions of dollars worth of funds under management. So,
yeah.
One of the topics we talked about briefly last time we met was you was involved in an entrepreneur's
organization,
which essentially was to essentially teach entrepreneurs how to be better business people, how to make networks, etc. So, yeah, how did that come about, and what's your involvement in that still?
Oh, so EO or EOS?
EOS.
That's EOS, okay. So, sort of related but different. So, EOS, well, again, it's an OBS story, right? So, a lot of the stuff we were doing in sort of growing quickly in OBS, we sort of read lots of books and stuff and came across this book called Rockefeller Habits. So Vern Harnish, I don't know if you know of him, but a lot of stuff, it's, you know, it talks about sort of business rhythms and quarterlies and annuals and just this sort of business rhythm that kind of makes things happen. And we, you know, to some degree we're taking that on board and we're doing that sort of meeting pulse and meeting rhythms. And I just, you know, we had such a formative experience really from the OBS world and the people around. I was like, oh, I want to recreate that somehow. And then looking further into that, I was like, who else is doing this stuff? And then I stumbled across this book by Gino Wickman, and there's a link between Vern and Gino. They're both part of EO. They were part of EO together, so Entrepreneurs Organization. Vern started it, and Gino was part of building a Detroit chapter. Very, very similar stories. And the EOS stuff just sort of was easy to consume. I was actually, believe it or not, meeting with the guys who, Vern's company, which is a company called Gazelles, and meeting with the guy who was sort of representing the EOS team, a guy called Dan Davis, on the same day. The Gazelles guy didn't turn up. I spoke to Dan. And then I was like, oh, yeah, this sounds like pretty much the things we were doing. It's very, very similar. It's like laid out as a process. And I guess I'm probably a process person, really, to kind of use as a blueprint to operate around. And so I kind of got involved with that. I'm in EOS terms, I'm a quick start. So pretty much get into things straight away and go, what's the risk? Whatever, we'll figure that out later. And sort of end up being, I'm a real big advocate of EOS, and we use EOS in our business today as well too. But for entrepreneurs, when things are running fast and you're just looking for some structure, and again, my mantra is really, my why is make it better. How do we make it better? And some of that is actually taking decisions out of what you need to do. So if you know how to kind of structure it as an organization and give that structure to someone else so you can let go of it, so get out of the way.
Yep.
To me, that's perfect, because it's like, right, set it up. Everyone's comfortable. They get what they want. And I can also go, it's yours.
Yeah.
See ya.
So we'll put that in the show notes, the details of that organization. But yeah, I thought for people running a business that's looking for a framework, or I suppose you're standing on the shoulder of giants to a certain extent, because you're kind of learning from others' mistakes, and it gives you a system, right? And there's a lot of systems out there.
I think, like, and again, you look at this and you go, we could choose any number of systems, right? And it's sort of in my experience, I think this is just one of those ones you can adopt and get on and get quickly. Especially if you're trying to grow. So for the growing bit is the hard bit. How do you structure in a way that actually you can get yourself out of the way? Talk to what you were talking about before. What is it about that next set of hires? What do they need to look like? How do you build a leadership team? What's the right way to do things? And how do you make that available to more than just the leadership team in a way that sort of can be taught to the leadership team first and sort of the flow down as well too? Yeah. So it brings together a whole bunch of concepts. There's nothing really, like, it's not a new thing. It's actually just, it ties together a bunch of stuff from a lot of great management texts, Lencioni and others, who so a lot of people read these things and they go, I'll try and implement it.
Yeah.
Just makes it a bit easier to kind of tie it all together and do it.
Yeah.
Okay, and I wouldn't be a proper podcast host if I didn't mention AI in any one of these sessions. So I guess from your perspective, you're obviously a little bit more privileged in understanding complex technology and the benefits for that business. And I think, for me, a lot of the AI stuff is stuff that's probably been around for a little while. It's just that we're a little bit more aware of its possibilities. But if you're a typical, say, business owner in Queensland or Brisbane, and, either worried or concerned or, just trying to think about what AI can do for their business, how would you kind of, put your arm around their shoulder and say, like, this is what's going to be happening with AI in the next sort of 10 years?
Well, again, it probably depends what type of business they're in, but, you know, if it's sort of services,
Let's go a professional sort, but they make stuff, you know, like could be building or whatever, you know.
Yeah, well, I think there's like the stuff that's like easy to access now, which is probably what everyone's hearing. It's the what are you doing to kind of get your content, taking the, I guess, the burden out of that content generation. So for like text content or image content or whatever it is, take the burden out so that you can iterate more often. So it doesn't necessarily, what it does, it gives you optionality. Whereas before, when you're building content and you're trying to drive things that are marketing driven or content driven, you spend a lot of time on the content to actually make sure it's right. And you know, or you're outsourcing it to someone to make sure it's right. Then you're checking it. So AI like fundamentally just gives you this ability to kind of iterate that really, really quickly. So instead of spending all your time trying to make sure you've written, you're starting to think about, I'm going to spend most of my time now on thinking about, is that the right angle? How many angles can I check, test, and then create content that's actually about testing? And then making, because it happens so quickly, you can have lots of options. So optionality is probably the around whatever the subject matter is. Same for images as well too, and images is an interesting one, and now video as well too, and like it's combining stuff in different ways that you wouldn't otherwise. You'd have to have a graphics editor or a video editor who knows how to use these tools to make these things happen, and now it can happen really quickly. And actually, do people want long video or is it actually short sharp, and you know what they're looking for? So it just creates lots more options that you can then get lost in and test.
Yeah, I think what's interesting for me is we mentioned about process, right? So, you know, when you've built tools like SharePoint and even some of the new ones like in the Power Platform, obviously you have to understand the business process.
Yes.
And what's been interesting for me, some of the recent work that I've been doing, is that you almost have to reinvent the process, because, you know, essentially the labor intensive manual steps that you probably had to do, you know, 5-6 years ago, you no longer have to do. So like, you know, so I mean, I'm always asking the question, you know, it isn't a case of, you know, if you can use AI, it's actually, you know, if you can, based on what, you know, with blank sheet of paper, what could you get it to do? And like, and in some cases, you know, we've been able to turn 80% manual into 80%, you know, automated.
Yeah.
But you can only do that if you are prepared to rip up the process. And I think that's where a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of business owners probably don't want to go. So.
Oh, no. I mean, I'd probably challenge that a little bit where, you know, it's more that they don't see the link between what they're doing and how that's going to help. Yeah. And so I think part of it's actually putting the shine in the light and saying, well, you know, in time, quite frankly, you tell any entrepreneur or speak to any entrepreneur, they'll say, what's my biggest issue? And it's time. I haven't got time to do the things I need to do. And, you know, and I'm running out of time, and time is a function of not delegating, and then actually not understanding it, and that they could actually find someone to do the things that they think they're the only ones who can do.
Yeah. You know, I agree, and I think the other big thing that I'm quite passionate about is I think we've all fallen into the trap of asking what do you want the tool to do. So it was a classic with SharePoint, remember, like 5-6 years ago, what do you want SharePoint to do? And people go, well, what does it do? And you go, well, it does a heap of things, and it can make the dinner as well, it can sweep up pretty much. And you know, as well as I do in the consulting world, it's the worst question you can ask. It's actually, you know, what's your challenges, what's your problems? And it's amazing how people just look at me and they go well just make some recommendations. And you go, well, if I don't understand your business, how am I meant to help? Yeah. But we've all fallen into a trap, and even today, you know, I saw something released, it's like, oh, it's a co-pilot readiness. And I was like, well, readiness for what? You know, what are you getting ready for? You know, it's a tool at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So yes, yeah, be interesting to see how that maps out.
Well, I mean, for me, like just on the AI topic, I was fortunate enough to be part of SaaS summit that was in Sydney. I spoke at on actually on the HR panel too, but some of the people who spoke from Insight Capital, Insight Partners in New York, they sort of talked a little bit about this, you know, what's Gen AI looking like, and how's it going to affect things? And really, you know, their message is too that the fact that we can have so much optionality and things can be generated so quickly, that actually it's affecting the way people like Google think about how they change the search results. Yeah. And like, it's actually got this flow-on effect because we were sort of limited by our ability to, as humans, kind of process and do things in that sort of way. So it's really going to speed that whole world up.
On that note, we had a nice segue. So as I mentioned on the way in, I used Copilot to try and do some meeting preparation. And it mentioned that Data Weavers have just recently secured Series A funding, And I had to ask you then. I was like, is that right? He's like, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well done, Copilot. So it's obviously doing some good stuff. But I suppose on that note.
How much time did that save you?
A lot of time. Yeah. I mean, look, once again, that probably would have taken me a good half hour, 45 minutes by sitting down and, you know, clicking around the web and, you know, looking at your website. And it was just, you know, I still did a bit of that, but it saved me. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's 45 minutes is, there we go. Microsoft will have that one as a case study. But where I was leading with that was funding. So that's another, certainly for tech businesses and for, you know, SaaS businesses and software businesses. Obviously funding's dried up and, you know, there's not as much money sloshing around, but you guys managed to secure money. So once again, when anything consciously you did, or was there anything you kind of had to think about before you went and try and raise that money, or, you know, or not?
Look, money, so raising money is about trying to accelerate outcomes, really. So when you're competing for market share, the faster you can get market share, you know, the better. And when it comes to product, and so we've got a fairly clear target market, and we know who they are, and they're spread worldwide. So, you know, the faster we can get in front of them, the faster we can sort of qualify them to be, you know, interested in our product. so really the way I sort of think about funding is it's like pouring fuel on the fire to get what you want to get done. So you've got to have things working first. Taking capital too early is also, you know, it's a bit of a trap, I suppose, because you think that that's what's going to get you to build the thing you want, which, not look, let's be honest, a lot of people need that to kind of get the idea off the ground. And I have a view that, you know, a lot of that sort of like first $1 million or whatever of that test has to kind of come from a bit of sweat equity and sweat figuring things out, getting and understanding whether product market fits there and other things like that too. So when you sort of raise, to me, it's about raising to get to the next level and try and
force. And quicker. Yeah. Ten times quicker.
Yeah. It's a 10x thing.
Yeah.
So, and it's interesting, the market is like, if you've got good again, I'm going to sound like a financial guy now, but like if you've got good metrics and you understand what people are looking for when you're raising money, and money's always there. So good businesses, money is always there, generally speaking. It just does put the fear of God into you a little bit and saying, oh, God, you know, well, maybe I'm not going to be good enough. But as it turns out, if you've got a really good understanding about what the metrics that these companies and capital, venture capital and private equity are looking for, it's actually making sure you can figure out how you run your business to that and taking on board things as well too. And so it's got a little bit like reverse engineer where you want to be, you know, test that you've got something that people want, reverse engineer where you want to be, and then kind of continually change, because, like, you know, even with a clear target like that, things change all the time. You've got to pivot, markets change.
Do you think, I suppose you have to be careful how I say it. So one thing I've also noticed is a few people probably had conversations with 4 or 5 years ago going, oh, I'd never sell or don't need any money. And then you see, like, you know, recently that they've sold or they've done a merger, apparently.
Yeah.
Through the little inverted comments. But we all know what that means as well. And I guess been a lot of that going, and I suppose someone always said to me, like, you know, we're in downtimes, it becomes opportunities as well.
Yeah,
right? But I guess do you think there's because I'd probably put myself in that category as well. There was always a reluctance to take any money or investment, and then you actually realize that, you know, you can get it, like, say, twice or three times as quicker.
Yeah.
But do you think a lot of businesses, they need to get over their ego a little bit sometimes to, you know, to take that money on board?
I think Well, perhaps there's a mix. Like, there's definitely, I mean, you've got to have ego to start a business, quite frankly. So if you don't have the ego, then it's going to be harder to kind of get to zero and then from zero to one type thing. And I think it probably would depend too. So I think that if you're in services, I've probably got a view about services businesses, like really good value from services businesses, running profitable. And so being really refined and knowing exactly how that business model works and just being good at making EBITDA. And, like, that's just good business sense too, quite frankly. Yeah. So when it comes to product or stuff that actually you've got to build first before you can get it into the hands of people, you can shortcut that by, you know, finding customers and doing it in a joint way as well too. But ultimately there's a point where you have to actually spend more money than you've got to actually get to the markets you want to go. And that's probably where it makes sense to – that's like a leverage play to do things. So I'm probably more inclined to, for me personally, you know, figure out how you leverage product and then services. You know, there's lots of different ways to do services. You can join forces. You can, you know, you can find other people, sort of like my situation, that I probably should have done in hindsight, yeah, merge DCG and OBS together, yeah, and it would have been a very different, yeah, different world.
Thing. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And then as we bring the interview to a close, just one final question. What would you say was your one thing that you did that accelerated your business or made your business more productive? Yeah, business productivity is the theme of Time and Motion. Yeah, so what was the one thing you'd say I did and I could look back and go, yeah, that accelerated our productivity?
For which business? For all of them? Any of them? All of them.
Best one you can think of.
Accelerated productivity. For me, it's taking that. So I'm going to say it's actually probably EOS. So, and the reason for that is it's taken all the fluff out of the framework of how to run a business. And you can easily spend a lot of time just dealing with sort of edge cases of everything instead of saying, well, this is the way and we can run it. So EOS definitely for me is, and across a whole bunch of businesses, right, that's kind of my default now. It's like, that's how we start. Everything starts that way. Yeah. Everyone knows how it works. So it's just, it's consistent. It's a massive time saver. So from a productivity, like, you know, we're doing things more and better. It's a massive tick. And then I'd say from an effectiveness point of view, which I think about, you know, just to put a spin on the productivity, a lot of people talk about productivity because that's how you measure things, but productivity is very hard to measure. Mm. I think about it these days more as effectiveness. So can I do things more effectively rather than just sort of try and measure some arbitrary productivity metric? And yeah, I'd say even by that measure too, anything that we're doing from implementing EOS, it's like we're much more effective at meetings. We're much more effective actually getting, you know, our goals set and done. We're much more effective at making sure that if we miss something, we actually figure it out quickly. We're much more effective that, you know, we can revisit things quarterly and that we can pivot. So a lot of that stuff is probably another way to think about it, yep, too.
Okay. Ben, so thanks so much for this second attempt at the podcast. And I feel that this one definitely flowed a little bit better and less noisy tractors in the background.
Yeah, it was airplanes last time.
Airplanes, yeah. Sorry. And yeah, obviously, yeah. And the rain, I think, was pretty noisy. But yeah, really appreciate your time. And thanks for giving me some insights into the Brisbane and the international business landscape. And wish your business every success in the future. And I'm sure we'll stay in touch.
Yeah, thanks, Lee.
Yeah.
Great, thanks, mate.
Cheers. Take care. Bye. So that's another great episode done and dusted. As always, I'd love to hear from you if you know anyone that's got a really good story to tell about how they are or not living a productive life. If you want to get in touch with me, please do so via my website, www.leestevens.co. That's www.leestevens.co. You can email me, lee@leestevens.co, or get in touch on LinkedIn, which is where I also hang out. In the meantime, have a good week.